Part 2. Beyond the Minimal State. Chapter 7. Distributive Justice. The minimal state is the most extensive state that can be justified. Any state more extensive violates people's rights. Yet many persons have put forth reasons purporting to justify a more extensive state. It is impossible within the compass of this audiobook to examine all the reasons that have been put forth. Therefore, I shall focus upon those generally acknowledged to be the most weighty and influential, to see precisely wherein they fail. In this chapter, we consider the claim that a more extensive state is justified because necessary, or the best instrument, to achieve distributive justice. In the next chapter, we shall take up diverse other claims. The term distributive justice is not a neutral one. Hearing the term distribution, most people presume that some thing or mechanism uses some principle or criterion to give out a supply of things. Into this process of distributing shares, some error may have crept. So it is an open question, at least, whether redistribution should take place, whether we should do again what has already been done once, though poorly. However, we are not in the position of children who have been given portions of pie by someone who now makes last-minute adjustments to rectify careless cutting. There is no central distribution, no person or group entitled to control all the resources, jointly deciding how they are to be doled out. What each person gets, he gets from others who give to him in exchange for something or as a gift. In a free society, diverse persons control different resources, and new holdings arise out of the voluntary exchanges and actions of persons. There is no more a distributing or distribution of shares than there is a distributing of mates in a society in which persons choose whom they shall marry. The total result is the product of many individual decisions which the different individuals involved are entitled to make. Some uses of the term distribution, it is true, do not imply a previous distributing appropriately judged by some criterion, for example, probability distribution. Nevertheless, despite the title of this chapter, it would be best to use a terminology that clearly is neutral. We shall speak of people's holdings. A principle of justice in holdings describes part of what justice tells us requires about holdings. I shall state first what I take to be the correct view about justice in holdings, and then turn to the discussion of alternate views. Section 1. The Entitlement Theory. The subject of justice in holdings consists of three major topics. The first is the original acquisition of holdings, the appropriation of unheld things. This includes the issues of how unheld things may come to be held, the process or processes by which unheld things may come to be held, the things that may come to be held by these processes, the extent of what comes to be held by a particular process, and so on. We shall refer to the complicated truth about this topic, which we shall not formulate here, as the principle of justice in acquisition. The second topic concerns the transfer of holdings from one person to another. By what processes may a person transfer holdings to another? How may a person acquire a holding from another who holds it? Under this topic come general descriptions of voluntary exchange and gift and, on the other hand, fraud, as well as reference to particular conventional details fixed upon in a given society. The complicated truth about this subject, with placeholders for conventional details, we shall call the principle of justice in transfer, and we shall suppose it also includes principles governing how a person may divest himself of a holding, passing it into an unheld state. If the world were wholly just, the following inductive definition would exhaustively cover the subject of justice in holdings. 1. A person who acquires a holding in accordance with the principle of justice in acquisition is entitled to that holding. 2. A person who acquires a holding in accordance with the principle of justice in transfer from someone else entitled to the holding is entitled to the holding. 3. No one is entitled to a holding except by repeated applications of 1 and 2. The complete principle of distributive justice would say simply that a distribution is just if everyone is entitled to the holdings they possess under the distribution. A distribution is just if it arises from another just distribution by legitimate means. The legitimate means of moving from one distribution to another are specified by the principle of justice in transfer. The legitimate first moves are specified by the principle of justice in acquisition. Applications of the principle of justice in acquisition may also occur as part of the move from one distribution to another. You may find an unheld thing now and appropriate it. Acquisitions also are to be understood as included when, to simplify, I speak only of transitions by transfers. Whatever arises from a just situation by just steps is itself just. The means of change specified by the principle of justice in transfer preserve justice. As correct rules of inference are truth-preserving, and any conclusion deduced via repeated application of such rules from only true premises is itself true, so the means of transition from one situation to another specified by the principle of justice in transfer are justice-preserving, and any situation actually arising from repeated transitions in accordance with the principle from a just situation is itself just. The parallel between justice-preserving transformations and truth-preserving transformations illuminates where it fails as well as where it holds. That a conclusion could have been deduced by truth-preserving means from premises that are true suffices to show its truth. That from a just situation, a situation could have arisen via justice-preserving means does not suffice to show its justice. The fact that a thief's victims voluntarily could have presented him with gifts does not entitle the thief to his ill-gotten gains. Justice in holdings is historical. It depends upon what actually has happened. We shall return to this point later. Not all actual situations are generated in accordance with the two principles of justice in holdings, the principle of justice in acquisition and the principle of justice in transfer. Some people steal from others or defraud them or enslave them, seizing their product and preventing them from living as they choose, or forcibly exclude others from competing in exchanges. None of these are permissible modes of transition from one situation to another, and some persons acquire holdings by means not sanctioned by the principle of justice in acquisition. The existence of past injustice, previous violations of the first two principles of justice in holdings, raises the third major topic under justice in holdings, the rectification of injustice in holdings. If past injustice has shaped present holdings in various ways, some identifiable and some not, what now, if anything, ought to be done to rectify these injustices? What obligations do the performers of injustice have toward those whose position is worse than it would have been had the injustice not been done, or than it would have been had compensation been paid promptly? How, if at all, do things change if the beneficiaries, and those made worse off, are not the direct parties in the act of injustice, but, for example, their descendants? Is an injustice done to someone whose holding was itself based upon an unrectified injustice? How far back must one go in wiping clean the historical slate of injustices? What may victims of injustice permissibly do in order to rectify the injustices being done to them, including the many injustices done by persons acting through their government? I do not know of a thorough or theoretically sophisticated treatment of such issues. Idealizing greatly, let us suppose theoretical investigation will produce a principle of rectification. This principle uses historical information about previous situations and injustices done in them, as defined by the first two principles of justice and rights against interference, and information about the actual course of events that flowed from these injustices until the present, and it yields a description or descriptions of holdings in the society. The principle of rectification presumably will make use of its best estimate of subjunctive information about what would have occurred, or probability distribution over what might have occurred, using the expected value, if the injustice had not taken place. If the actual description of holdings turns out not to be one of the descriptions yielded by the principle, then one of the descriptions yielded must be realized. If the principle of rectification of violations of the first two principles yields more than one description of holdings, then some choice must be made as to which of these is to be realized. Perhaps the sort of considerations about distributive justice and equality that I argue against play a legitimate role in this subsidiary choice. Similarly, there may be room for such considerations in deciding which otherwise arbitrary features a statute will embody, when such features are unavoidable because other considerations do not specify a precise line, yet a line must be drawn. The general outlines of the theory of justice in holdings are that the holdings of a person are just if he is entitled to them by the principles of justice in acquisition and transfer, or by the principle of rectification of injustice, as specified by the first two principles. If each person's holdings are just, then the total set, distribution of holdings, is just. To turn these general outlines into a specific theory, we would have to specify the details of each of the three principles of justice in holdings: the principle of acquisition of holdings, the principle of transfer of holdings, and the principle of rectification of violations of the first two principles. I shall not attempt that task here. Locke's principle of justice in acquisition will be discussed shortly. Historical principles and end-result principles. The general outlines of the entitlement theory illuminate the nature and defects of other conceptions of distributive justice. The entitlement theory of justice in distribution is historical. Whether a distribution is just depends on how it came about. In contrast, current time-slice principles of justice hold that the justice of a distribution is determined by how things are distributed. Who has what is judged by some structural principles of just distribution. A utilitarian who judges between any two distributions by seeing which has the greater sum of utility, and if the sums tie, applies some fixed equality criterion to choose the more equal distribution, would hold a current time-slice principle of justice, as would someone who had a fixed schedule of trade-offs between the sum of happiness and equality. According to a current time-slice principle, all that needs to be looked at in judging the justice of a distribution is who ends up with what. In comparing any two distributions, one need look only at the matrix presenting the distributions. No further information need be fed into a principle of justice. It is a consequence of such principles of justice that any two structurally identical distributions are equally just. Two distributions are structurally identical if they present the same profile, but perhaps have different persons occupying the particular slots. My having 10 and your having 5, and my having 5 and your having 10 are structurally identical distributions. Welfare economics is the theory of current time-slice principles of justice. The subject is conceived as operating on matrices representing only current information about distribution. This, as well as some of the usual conditions, for example, the choice of distribution is invariant under relabeling of columns, guarantees that welfare economics will be a current time-slice theory, with all of its inadequacies. Most persons do not accept current time-slice principles as constituting the whole story about distributive shares. They think it relevant in assessing the justice of a situation to consider not only the distribution it embodies, but also how that distribution came about. If some persons are in prison for murder or war crimes, we do not say that to assess the justice of the distribution in the society, we must look only at what this person has, and that person has, and that person has, at the current time. We think it relevant to ask whether someone did something so that he deserved to be punished, deserved to have a lower share. Most will agree to the relevance of further information with regard to punishments and penalties. Consider also desired things. One traditional socialist view is that workers are entitled to the product and full fruits of their labor. They have earned it. A distribution is unjust if it does not give the workers what they are entitled to. Such entitlements are based upon some past history. No socialist holding this view would find it comforting to be told that because the actual distribution A happens to coincide structurally with the one he desires, D, A, therefore, is no less just than D, It differs only in that the parasitic owners of capital receive under A what the workers are entitled to under D, and the workers receive under A what the owners are entitled to under D, namely very little. This socialist rightly, in my view, holds on to the notions of earning, producing, entitlement, desert, and so forth. And he rejects current time-slice principles that look only to the structure of the resulting set of holdings. The set of holdings resulting from what? Isn't it implausible that how holdings are produced and come to exist has no effect at all on who should hold what? His mistake lies in his view of what entitlements arise out of what sorts of productive processes. We construe the position we discuss too narrowly by speaking of current time-slice principles. Nothing has changed if structural principles operate upon a time sequence of current time-slice profiles, and, for example, give someone more now to counterbalance the less he has had earlier. A utilitarian or an egalitarian or any mixture of the two over time will inherit the difficulties of his more myopic comrades. He is not helped by the fact that some of the information others consider relevant in assessing a distribution is reflected unrecoverably in past matrices. Henceforth, we shall refer to such unhistorical principles of distributive justice, including the current time-slice principles, as end-result principles or end-state principles. In contrast to end-result principles of justice, historical principles of justice hold that past circumstances or actions of people can create differential entitlements or differential deserts to things. An injustice can be worked by moving from one distribution to another structurally identical one, for the second, in profile the same, may violate people's entitlements or deserts. It may not fit the actual history. Patterning. The entitlement principles of justice in holdings that we have sketched are historical principles of justice. To better understand their precise character, we shall distinguish them from another subclass of the historical principles. Consider as an example the principle of distribution according to moral merit. This principle requires that total distributive shares vary directly with moral merit. No person should have a greater share than anyone whose moral merit is greater. If moral merit could not be merely ordered but measured on an interval or ratio scale, stronger principles could be formulated. Or consider the principle that results by substituting usefulness to society for moral merit in the previous principle. Or instead of distribute according to moral merit, or distribute according to usefulness to society, we might consider distribute according to the weighted sum of moral merit, usefulness to society, and need, with the weights of the different dimensions equal. Let us call a principle of distribution patterned if it specifies that a distribution is to vary along with some natural dimension, weighted sum of natural dimensions, or lexicographic ordering of natural dimensions. And let us say a distribution is patterned if it accords with some patterned principle. I speak of natural dimensions, admittedly, without a general criterion for them, because for any set of holdings, some artificial dimensions can be gimmicked up to vary along with the distribution of the set. The principle of distribution in accordance with moral merit is a patterned historical principle, which specifies a patterned distribution. Distribute according to IQ is a patterned principle that looks to information not contained in distributional matrices. It is not historical, however, in that it does not look to any past actions creating differential entitlements to evaluate a distribution. It requires only distributional matrices whose columns are labeled by IQ scores. The distribution in a society, however, may be composed of such simple patterned distributions without itself being simply patterned. Different sectors may operate different patterns, or some combination of patterns may operate in different proportions across a society. A distribution composed in this manner, from a small number of pattern distributions, we also shall term patterned, and we extend the use of pattern to include the overall designs put forth by combinations of end-state principles. Almost every suggested principle of distributive justice is patterned, to each according to his moral merit or needs or marginal product or how hard he tries or the weighted sum of the foregoing, and so on. The principle of entitlement we have sketched is not patterned. One might try to squeeze a patterned conception of distributive justice into the framework of the entitlement conception by formulating a gimmicky, obligatory principle of transfer that would lead to the pattern. For example, the principle that if one has more than the mean income, one must transfer everything one holds above the mean to persons below the mean, so as to bring them up to, but not over, the mean. We can formulate a criterion for a principle of transfer to rule out such obligatory transfers, or we can say that no correct principle of transfer, no principle of transfer in a free society, will be like this. The former is probably the better course, though the latter also is true. Alternatively, one might think to make the entitlement conception instantiate a pattern by using matrix entries that express the relative strength of a person's entitlements as measured by some real valued function. But even if the limitation to natural dimensions failed to exclude this function, the resulting edifice would not capture our system of entitlements to particular things. There is no one natural dimension or weighted sum or combination of a small number of natural dimensions that yields the distributions generated in accordance with the principle of entitlement. The set of holdings that results when some persons receive their marginal products, others win at gambling, others receive a share of their mate's income, others receive gifts from foundations, others receive interest on loans, others receive gifts from admirers, others receive returns on investment, others make for themselves much of what they have, others find things, and so on, will not be patterned. Heavy strands of patterns will run through it. Significant portions of the variance in holdings will be accounted for by pattern variables. If most people most of the time choose to transfer some of their entitlements to others, only in exchange for something from them, then a large part of what many people hold will vary with what they held that others wanted. More details are provided by the theory of marginal productivity. But gifts to relatives, charitable donations, bequests to children and the like are not best conceived in the first instance in this manner. Ignoring the strands of pattern, let us suppose for the moment that a distribution actually arrived at by the operation of the principle of entitlement is random with respect to any pattern. Though the resulting set of holdings will be unpatterned, it will not be incomprehensible, for it can be seen as arising from the operation of a small number of principles. These principles specify how an initial distribution may arise, the principle of acquisition of holdings, and how distributions may be transformed into others, the principle of transfer of holdings. The process whereby the set of holdings is generated will be intelligible, though the set of holdings itself that results from this process will be unpatterned. The writings of F.A. Hayek focus less than is usually done upon what patterning distributive justice requires. Hayek argues that we cannot know enough about each person's situation to distribute to each according to his moral merit, but would justice demand we do so if we did have this knowledge? And he goes on to say, "Our objection is against all attempts to impress upon society a deliberately chosen pattern of distribution, whether it be an order of equality or of inequality." However, Hayek concludes that in a free society there will be distribution in accordance with value rather than moral merit, that is, in accordance with the perceived value of a person's actions and services to others. Despite his rejection of a patterned conception of distributive justice, Hayek himself suggests a pattern he thinks justifiable. Distribution in accordance with the perceived benefits given to others, leaving room for the complaint that a free society does not realize exactly this pattern. Stating this patterned strand of a free capitalist society more precisely, we get, "To each according to how much he benefits others who have the resources for benefiting those who benefit them." This will seem arbitrary unless some acceptable initial set of holdings is specified, or unless it is held that the operation of the system over time washes out any significant effects from the initial set of holdings. As an example of the latter, if almost anyone would have bought a car from Henry Ford, the supposition that it was an arbitrary matter who held the money then, and so bought, would not place Henry Ford's earnings under a cloud. In any event, his coming to hold it is not arbitrary. Distribution according to benefits to others is a major pattern strand in a free capitalist society, as Hayek correctly points out, but it is only a strand and does not constitute the whole pattern of a system of entitlements, namely inheritance, gifts for arbitrary reasons, charity, and so on, or a standard that one should insist a society fit. Will people tolerate for long a system yielding distributions that they believe are unpatterned? No doubt people will not long accept a distribution they believe is unjust. People want their society to be and to look just. But must the look of justice reside in a resulting pattern rather than in the underlying generating principles? We are in no position to conclude that the inhabitants of a society embodying an entitlement conception of justice in holdings will find it unacceptable. Still, it must be granted that were people's reasons for transferring some of their holdings to others always irrational or arbitrary, we would find this disturbing. Suppose people always determined what holdings they would transfer and to whom by using a random device. We feel more comfortable upholding the justice of an entitlement system if most of the transfers under it are done for reasons. This does not mean necessarily that all deserve what holdings they receive. It means only that there is a purpose or point to someone's transferring a holding to one person rather than to another, that usually we can see what the transferor thinks he's gaining, what cause he thinks he's serving, what goals he thinks he's helping to achieve, and so forth. Since in a capitalist society people often transfer holdings to others in accordance with how much they perceive these others benefiting them, the fabric constituted by the individual transactions and transfers is largely reasonable and intelligible. Gifts to loved ones, bequests to children, charity to the needy also are non-arbitrary components of the fabric. We certainly benefit because great economic incentives operate to get others to spend much time and energy to figure out how to serve us by providing things we will want to pay for. It is not mere paradox-mongering to wonder whether capitalism should be criticized for most rewarding, and hence encouraging, not individualists like Thoreau, who go about their own lives, but people who are occupied with serving others and winning them as customers. But to defend capitalism, one need not think businessmen are the finest human types. I do not mean to join here the general maligning of businessmen either. Those who think the finest should acquire the most can try to convince their fellows to transfer resources in accordance with that principle. In stressing the large strand of distribution in accordance with benefit to others, Hayek shows the point of many transfers, and so shows that the system of transfer of entitlements is not just spinning its gears aimlessly. The system of entitlements is defensible when constituted by the individual aims of individual transactions. No overarching aim is needed, no distributional pattern is required. To think that the task of a theory of distributive justice is to fill in the blank in to each according to his blank is to be predisposed to search for a pattern, and the separate treatment of from each according to his blank treats production and distribution as two separate and independent issues. On an entitlement view, these are not two separate questions. Whoever makes something, having bought or contracted for all other held resources used in the process, transferring some of his holdings for these cooperating factors, is entitled to it. The situation is not one of something's getting made, and there being an open question, who is to get it? Things come into the world already attached to people having entitlements over them. From the point of view of the historical entitlement conception of justice in holdings, those who start afresh to complete to each according to his blank treat objects as if they appeared from nowhere, out of nothing. A complete theory of justice might cover this limit case as well. Perhaps here is a use for the usual conceptions of distributive justice. So entrenched are maxims of the usual form that perhaps we should present the entitlement conception as a competitor. Ignoring acquisition and rectification, we might say, from each according to what he chooses to do, to each according to what he makes for himself, perhaps with the contracted aid of others, and what others choose to do for him and choose to give him of what they've been given previously under this maxim and haven't yet expended or transferred. This, the discerning listener will have noticed, has its defects as a slogan. So as a summary and great simplification, and not as a maxim with any independent meaning, we have, from each as they choose, to each as they are chosen. How liberty upsets patterns. It is not clear how those holding alternative conceptions of distributive justice can reject the entitlement conception of justice in holdings. For suppose a distribution favored by one of these non-entitlement conceptions is realized. Let us suppose it is your favorite one, and let us call this distribution D sub 1. Perhaps everyone has an equal share. Perhaps shares vary in accordance with some dimension you treasure. Now suppose that Wilt Chamberlain is greatly in demand by basketball teams, being a great gate attraction. Also suppose contracts run only for a year, with players being free agents. He signs the following sort of contract with a team. In each home game, 25 cents from the price of each ticket of admission goes to him. We ignore the question of whether he is gouging the owners. Let them look out for themselves. The season starts, and people cheerfully attend his team's games. They buy their tickets, each time dropping a separate 25 cents of their admission price into a special box with Chamberlain's name on it. They are excited about seeing him play. It is worth the total admission price to them. Let us suppose that in one season 1 million persons attend his home games, and Will Chamberlain winds up with $250,000, a much larger sum than the average income, and larger even than anyone else has. Is he entitled to this income? Is this new distribution D sub 2 unjust? If so, why? There is no question about whether each of the people was entitled to the control over the resources they held in D sub 1, because that was the distribution, your favorite, that for purposes of argument we assumed was acceptable. Each of these persons chose to give 25 cents of their money to Chamberlain. They could have spent it on going to the movies, or on candy bars, or on copies of Dissent magazine, or of Monthly Review. But they all, at least 1 million of them, converged on giving it to Will Chamberlain in exchange for watching him play basketball. If D sub 1 was just distribution, and people voluntarily moved from it to D sub 2, transferring parts of their shares they were given under D sub 1, what was it for if not to do something with? Isn't D sub 2 also just? If the people were entitled to dispose of the resources to which they were entitled under D sub 1, didn't this include their being entitled to give it to or exchange it with Wilt Chamberlain? Can anyone else complain on grounds of justice? Each other person already has his legitimate share under D sub 1. Under D sub 1, there is nothing that anyone has that anyone else has a claim of justice against. After someone transfers something to Wilt Chamberlain, third parties still have their legitimate shares. Their shares are not changed. By what process could such a transfer among two persons give rise to a legitimate claim of distributive justice on a portion of what was transferred by a third party who had no claim of justice on any holding of the others before the transfer? To cut off objections irrelevant here, we might imagine the exchanges occurring in a socialist society after hours. After playing whatever basketball he does in his daily work, or doing whatever other daily work he does, Wilt Chamberlain decides to put in overtime to earn additional money. First, his work quota is set. He works time over that. Or imagine it is a skilled juggler people like to see, who puts on shows after hours. Might not a transfer have instrumental effects on a third party, changing his feasible options? But what if the two parties to the transfer independently had used their holdings in this fashion? I discuss this question shortly, but note here that this question concedes the point for distributions of ultimate intrinsic non-instrumental goods, pure utility experiences, so to speak, that are transferable. It also might be objected that the transfer might make a third party more envious because it worsens his position relative to someone else. I find it incomprehensible how this can be thought to involve a claim of justice. On envy, refer to Chapter 8. Here and elsewhere in this chapter, a theory which incorporates elements of pure procedural justice might find what I say acceptable if kept in its proper place, that is, if background institutions exist to ensure the satisfaction of certain conditions on distributive shares. But if these institutions are not themselves the sum or invisible hand result of people's voluntary, non-aggressive actions, the constraints they impose require justification. At no point does our argument assume any background institutions more extensive than those of the minimal night watchman state, a state limited to protecting persons against murder, assault, theft, fraud, and so forth. Why might someone work overtime in a society in which it is assumed their needs are satisfied? Perhaps because they care about things other than needs. I like to write in books that I read, and to have easy access to books for browsing at odd hours. It would be very pleasant and convenient to have the resources of Widener Library in my backyard. No society, I assume, will provide such resources close to each person who would like them as part of his regular allotment under D-1. Thus, persons either must do without some extra things that they want, or be allowed to do something extra to get some of these things. On what basis could the inequalities that would eventuate be forbidden? Notice also that small factories would spring up in a socialist society unless forbidden. I melt down some of my personal possessions under D-1 and build a machine out of the material. I offer you and others a philosophy lecture once a week in exchange for your cranking the handle on my machine, whose products I exchange for yet other things, and so on. The raw materials used by the machine are given to me by others who possess them under D-1 in exchange for hearing lectures. Each person might participate to gain things over and above their allotment under D-1. Some persons even might want to leave their job in socialist industry and work full-time in this private sector. I shall say something more about these issues in the next chapter. Here I wish merely to note how private property, even in means of production, would occur in a socialist society that did not forbid people to use as they wished some of the resources they are given under the socialist distribution D-1. The socialist society would have to forbid capitalist acts between consenting adults. The general point illustrated by the Wilt Chamberlain example and the example of the entrepreneur in a socialist society is that no end-state principle or distributional-patterned principle of justice can be continuously realized without continuous interference with people's lives. Any favored pattern would be transformed into one unfavored by the principle, by people choosing to act in various ways, for example, by people exchanging goods and services with other people, or giving things to other people, things the transferors are entitled to under the favored distributional pattern. To maintain a pattern, one must either continually interfere to stop people from transferring resources as they wish to, or continually or periodically interfere to take from some persons resources that others, for some reason, chose to transfer to them. But if some time limit is to be set on how long people may keep resources others voluntarily transfer to them, why let them keep these resources for any period of time? Why not have immediate confiscation? It might be objected that all persons voluntarily will choose to refrain from actions which would upset the pattern. This presupposes unrealistically, 1, that all will most want to maintain the pattern, or those who don't, to be re-educated, or forced to undergo self-criticism, 2, that each can gather enough information about his own actions and the ongoing activities of others to discover which of his actions will upset the pattern, and 3, that diverse and far-flung persons can coordinate their actions to dovetail into the pattern. Compare the manner in which the market is neutral among persons' desires, as it reflects and transmits widely scattered information via prices, and coordinates persons' activities. It puts things perhaps a bit too strongly to say that every patterned or end-state principle is liable to be thwarted by the voluntary actions of the individual parties transferring some of their shares they receive under the principle. For perhaps some very weak patterns are not so thwarted. Any distributional pattern with any egalitarian component is overturnable by the voluntary actions of individual persons over time, as is every patterned condition with sufficient content so as actually to have been proposed as presenting the central core of distributive justice. Still, given the possibility that some weak conditions or patterns may not be unstable in this way, it would be better to formulate an explicit description of the kind of interesting and contentful patterns under discussion and to prove a theorem about their instability. Since the weaker the patterning, the more likely it is that the entitlement system itself satisfies it, a plausible conjecture is that any patterning either is unstable or is satisfied by the entitlement system. Is the patterned principle stable that requires merely that a distribution be Pareto optimal? One person might give another a gift or bequest that the second could exchange with a third to their mutual benefit. Before the second makes this exchange, there is not Pareto optimality. Is a stable pattern presented by a principle choosing that among the Pareto optimal positions that satisfies some further condition C? It may seem that there cannot be a counterexample, for won't any voluntary exchange made away from a situation show that the first situation wasn't Pareto optimal? Ignore the implausibility of this last claim for the case of bequests. But principles are to be satisfied over time, during which new possibilities arise. A distribution that at one time satisfies the criterion of Pareto optimality might not do so when some new possibilities arise. Wilt Chamberlain grows up and starts playing basketball. And though people's activities will tend to move then to a new Pareto optimal position, this new one need not satisfy the contentful condition C. Continual interference will be needed to ensure the continual satisfaction of C. The theoretical possibility of a pattern's being maintained by some invisible hand process that brings it back to an equilibrium that fits the pattern when deviations occur should be investigated. Sen's argument. Our conclusions are reinforced by considering a recent general argument of Amartya K. Sen. Suppose individual rights are interpreted as the right to choose which of two alternatives is to be more highly ranked in a social ordering of the alternatives. Add the weak condition that if one alternative unanimously is preferred to another, then it is ranked higher by the social ordering. If there are two different individuals, each with individual rights, interpreted as above, over different pairs of alternatives, having no members in common, then for some possible preference rankings of the alternatives by the individuals, there is no linear social ordering. For suppose that person A has the right to decide among X, Y, and person B has the right to decide among Z, W. And suppose their individual preferences are as follows, and that there are no other individuals. Person A prefers W to X to Y to Z, and person B prefers Y to Z to W to X. By the unanimity condition in the social ordering, W is preferred to X, since each individual prefers it to X, and Y is preferred to Z, since each individual prefers it to Z. Also in the social ordering, X is preferred to Y by person A's right of choice among these two alternatives. Combining these three binary rankings, we get W preferred to X, preferred to Y, preferred to Z in the social ordering. However, by person B's right of choice, Z must be preferred to W in the social ordering. There is no transitive social ordering satisfying all these conditions, and the social ordering, therefore, is nonlinear. Thus far, Sen. The trouble stems from treating an individual's right to choose among alternatives as the right to determine the relative ordering of these alternatives within a social ordering. The alternative which has individuals rank pairs of alternatives and separately rank the individual alternatives is no better. Their ranking of pairs feeds into some method of amalgamating preferences to yield a social ordering of pairs, and the choice among the alternatives in the highest-ranked pair in the social ordering is made by the individual with the right to decide between this pair. This system also has the result that an alternative may be selected, although everyone prefers some other alternative. For example, A selects X over Y, where XY somehow is the highest-ranked pair in the social ordering of pairs, although everyone, including A, prefers W to X. But the choice person A was given, however, was only between X and Y. A more appropriate view of individual rights is as follows. Individual rights are co-possible. Each person may exercise his rights as he chooses. The exercise of these rights fixes some features of the world. Within the constraints of these fixed features, a choice may be made by a social choice mechanism based upon a social ordering, if there are any choices left to make. Rights do not determine a social ordering, but instead set the constraints within which a social choice is to be made by excluding certain alternatives, fixing others, and so on. If I have a right to choose to live in New York or Massachusetts, and I choose Massachusetts, then alternatives involving my living in New York are not appropriate objects to be entered in a social ordering. Even if all possible alternatives are ordered first, apart from anyone's rights, the situation is not changed. For then, the highest-ranked alternative that is not excluded by anyone's exercise of his rights is instituted. Rights do not determine the position of an alternative or the relative position of two alternatives in a social ordering. They operate upon a social ordering to constrain the choice it can yield. If entitlements to holdings are rights to dispose of them, then social choice must take place within the constraints of how people choose to exercise these rights. If any patterning is legitimate, it falls within the domain of social choice, and hence is constrained by people's rights. How else can one cope with Sen's result? The alternative of first having a social ranking with rights exercised within its constraints is no alternative at all. Why not just select the top-ranked alternative and forget about rights? If that top-ranked alternative itself leaves some room for individual choice, and here is where rights of choice is supposed to enter in, there must be something to stop these choices from transforming it into another alternative. Thus, Sen's argument leads us again to the result that patterning requires continuous interference with individuals' actions and choices.